Welcome to the Borderless Podcast, your guide to traveling, investing, and living beyond borders, where we talk about living the life that you want to live, where you want to live it.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. This is today I have George Gammon on. A lot of people have been requesting him. He's been putting out some really great YouTube videos about real estate, the economy in general. So I thought I'd bring him on and we would talk about that. He's a great person living kind of a borderless lifestyle that we talk about. So thanks for coming on, George. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Yeah. So I know that you do spend a good amount of time in Medellin. Are you there now?
I'm not. No, okay. I was there during the lockdown. I've been doing real estate there for several years, since 2015. Mm-hmm. And I've got quite a few apartments there. But I was there and they just locked it down. You know, one day you're kind of running around and the next day you're not. So
yeah,
I was in the apartment for probably, oh boy, 4 or 5 months. And I finally got a humanitarian flight out of Medellin. And I love Medellin. I love Colombia.
Yeah. Yeah,
but
too.
I just wanted to go someplace that had fewer restrictions so I could kind of enjoy life. And the best place I could find that was kind of close in the Caribbean was St. Bart. So I got a humanitarian flight out of Medellin to Fort Lauderdale. And then it's kind of quite a logistical challenge. But then I finally got down to St. Bart's from Fort Lauderdale. So I've been here ever since then. Just kind of enjoying the beaches and snorkeling and scuba diving and kite surfing and just enjoying the little things such as the gym being open and the restaurants being open.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, that was disappointing. I have a lot of friends that are down there now. And yeah, they're still just, it was really kind of dramatic how they locked down like that. I don't know. So with the real estate, I mean, since it's not, you know, you're not getting a mortgage on there. I know you're familiar, or you started at least, I'm sure, in the U.S. I mean, that's a big difference between doing real estate investing in a pretty much a cash market, or are we using private loans, or how do you go about doing that?
Well, it's a huge difference, that's for sure. And a lot of people think that the United States is this, it's such a safe market. You know, when I say that I'm investing in Colombia, people say, oh my gosh, that's, it's got to be really risky, right? And I'm like, well, you got 97% of the people that own their properties outright with no debt compared to a market like the United States, where let's say 40 or 50% of the people have a big mortgage on their shoulders of their house. And then you've got the property taxes. So even if you pay off your house, you still don't really own it because the government or the state or the county has an indefinite lien on your property. And so I kind of get a kick out of that because I would argue that a market where they're far less draconian with the property taxes, although they have them, and that there's almost zero debt in the market is far safer, especially when you're in a market where a lot of the individuals look at real estate as their savings account.
Yep.
They hold their entire net worth a lot of times in all ranges, not just the middle class and upper class, but the poor, middle class, the upper class, the rich, everyone pretty much keeps their wealth in real estate. So I think it's a great market. I've been investing there, like I said, since 2015. But you're right, they don't have any leverage. So you've got to use quite a bit of cash. If you got the cash, it's a great place because the market is so inefficient and it's not as liquid. And therefore, if someone needs to sell, if you have a motivated seller, you can buy at significant discounts to retail. And even if you wanted to just wholesale it and just flip it to someone else and just you've got the capacity to hold it for, let's say, 6 months where the seller didn't, then, I mean, you can make 20-30% just doing that. And then if you go in and if you remodel it and then sell it or rent it out, the forced appreciation that you can have is just really staggering, especially when you compare it to a market like the United States. I mean, sometimes you get 50, 60, 100% returns if you really know what you're doing annualized. And I don't think most people realize that. The flip side of the coin is because the market is so inefficient, if you don't know what you're doing, you got problems.
Mm-hmm.
You got big problems. 9 times out of 10, you're going to lose money and a lot of money. But if you've got that local expertise, it's a huge edge.
Yeah. So how do you go? Do you do it yourself, or do you just find somebody in the market to help you, that, like a local?
Yeah. So I started investing in South America in 2013-14 in Ecuador. So I was very fortunate to meet a couple there. They're like family now. Their names are Angie and Joaquin. They're a young couple. And they started working for me in Ecuador on the coast in a place called Montanita. So Joaquin is an architect, Angie is a designer. And we did a small project there. And from the moment I met them, I knew that they were just top shelf. So when I started in Medellin, I bought the first project I bought there was giant. It was this about a 6,000 square foot penthouse. I kind of dove in head first. And I called Angie and Joaquin. They were in Ecuador. And I said, hey, listen, guys, I just bought this project up here. It's probably going to take us 6 to 9 months to remodel, but I'd love you guys to come up here and help me out with it. I'll pay your room and board, and I'll have you guys just focus on this project exclusively. And they said, yeah, we'll hop on the next flight. So that was 2015. That was our first project. Ended up taking us a year. And then the Medellin market was just blowing up at the time.
Yeah.
And when I was doing that project, all the gringos were coming down because they were wanting to buy properties, not necessarily to flip or for real estate investments, but for themselves. And they wanted to remodel them, and they didn't know what was going on, but they did know that there were a lot of, let's call them hidden dangers to the market and to really getting screwed by contractors or suppliers. So they would always say, hey, George, would you mind? I could take you out to dinner, so I'll buy you lunch, and you can tell me what to do and what not to do and some of your experiences. I kind of became that guy in Medellin, like the well-known real estate guy. And every time I'd talk to him, I'd just be honest, and I'd say, listen, if you really want this done right, you got to use Angie and Joaquin. And so their business just blew up as well. And then they had a couple kids, and now they've got this whole family. They're rooted in Medellin, and they've got, I mean, countless clients, especially before the virus hit. Their business was really, really booming. They probably had 20-30 employees, and they still do. I give them my projects exclusively. I don't work with anyone else. But they've got a lot more clients, and bigger clients, by the way, than just me. So that's how that whole process kind of evolved. And that's why I had a huge edge when I went there from the beginning, because not only did I understand real estate investing, and did I have a significant background as an entrepreneur, but I also had Angie and Joaquin there coming up from Ecuador that could handle hiring the electricians, the plumbers, the tile people, all the subs. Yeah. And although you still have to kiss a lot of frogs, you're not, you don't fall into some of the traps that others would. And you're still able to, even with the first project, we had a really good return on that. And we kind of never looked back.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess, the point is you got to put together a good team.
That's right.
And if they're kind of seen as somewhat local, at least you can skip some of what they call the gringo tax, and they can negotiate a little bit better for you, especially if they're native speakers of the language. I do the same thing. I think that, putting together a good team, obviously, no matter where it is, it's going to be really instrumental. And what I was going to say, too, also about Mexico, where I am, what you were saying about people that just put their money, use it kind of as a bank, that's very true here as well, because there's been so many devaluations and things like that people have experienced in their own lifetimes. A lot of times you just see people have land forever, and it'll be in the family. It'll be in 10 people's names. And the property tax is so low. I mean, people in the United States would not believe how low their property tax is in Mexico. So they could just keep it there. And they're not really motivated to sell at all. And I think it's kind of interesting also that if they buy land, maybe they'll put houses on different parts of it, and they have no intention of selling it, and the family kind of lives there. So, not from an investment standpoint, but I think it's kind of an interesting cultural thing that the family has a place, no matter what, that they can always come back to. Even if they went completely broke, anybody in the family knows that they can come back, and usually the parents live there and stuff like that. So I think it's kind of different from, you know, the U.S. We're used to moving around a lot and stuff.
I think it has a huge impact, especially right now.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Colombia, as an example, with this lockdown, their economy is obviously suffering. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's suffering close to what it was, at least on an individual level. I don't think the society is suffering as much as they are in the United States. Now, of course, the United States has the PPP loans and the stimulus checks and all these things that are kind of artificially keeping things afloat. But Colombia, it didn't seem as though they need that. And I'm not trying to downplay the significance of the virus on mm-hmm. the local economy or on individuals' paychecks. But to your point, first of all, most people own their property outright, so they don't have a rent payment. They don't have a mortgage payment. And even if you've got a small little home in like a strata 2 or 3 or even a 1, you've got, at a worst case scenario, you could have your cousins come over and mm-hmm. you've got maybe 4 or 5 people living there and they've got a roof over their head. So they don't have to worry about food. They don't have to worry about shelter. The basic necessities are taken care of because they've owned this real estate through generation after generation after generation. And it works very well as kind of a default form of a default security blanket that's private and not really at the discretion of the government.
Yeah. And, you know, also because of interest rates have a lot to do with that. I mean, in the United States, they give away very low interest rates, and that, you know, affects not only credit card, but as we're seeing now, auto loans, you know, credit card loans, giving out all these student loans and all this. So also when you're just completely up to your eyeballs in debt, you know, you can't miss, you know, if you get fired, you can't just miss a month or two of paycheck, which I guess we'll see how all that hits when they stop with these. Well, I guess what do they have now? $400 a week, enhanced unemployment benefits and all this. I mean, they're keeping this afloat somehow, but it is really a house of cards with all the debt that a lot of Americans are in. I don't know what's going to happen with this.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I've got several people that work for me now in Colombia. Call it, oh boy, maybe 25, 30 people, something like that. And excuse me, a lot of them are Venezuelan mm-hmm. and they fled Venezuela to come to have a better job, better life in Medellin and in Colombia. And I mean, if you look at their balance sheet, a lot of them, although they're relatively poor and would be poor by American standards, they've got a better balance sheet than half of Americans.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have any debt at all. And although they might be making $1,000 a month, excuse me, but they're making that $1,000 a month, their standard of that buys just as many goods and services as, call it, $5,000 a month in the United States. But they have absolutely no debt. They don't have student debt. They don't have a mortgage. They don't have a car payment. They really don't have any of these things. So, I mean, who's rich and who's poor?
Yeah. And also when your monthly expenses, I mean, like you're talking about, maybe you are renting something, even if you are renting something. I mean, a lot of people can, you know, say a household of two people, like, you know, for me here, I mean, I'm really amazed sometimes how low, if I wanted to, how little I could pay and survive. I mean, you know, as far as food, just going to like local markets and stuff. The food, you know, just making food at home and like most of the locals do. And if you don't have any mortgage, I mean, people would be blown away. I mean, you could probably get away. I mean, if you live in a family, get away, you know, paying nothing. But even if you and are supporting somebody else, you know, two people household, you probably could pay, you know, $200 to $500 a month or something and survive.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, which just
yeah. Especially if you've got dollar denominated cash flow coming in. So.
Oh, yeah.
As an example, if you're like me, I've got several properties in the United States, and I've got dollar, I don't know if you want to call it profit, cash flow, whatever, but I have dollars coming into my bank account every single month. And if your expenses are denominated in Colombian pesos or Mexican pesos, mm-hmm. I think you're at 22, 23 right now to the dollar, which is I mean, that is crazy. I don't think most people understand that just what, maybe 6-7 years ago, that was 7. So yeah. Think about how much more purchasing power you have in Mexico right now compared to when you did back then, if you've got dollars coming in and you're buying pesos to buy goods and services. I mean, there is massive, massive purchasing power because of the difference in the currency, because the dollar is so strong relative to those currencies. And I don't think most people put two and two together there. In addition to that, you've got just, even if they were, even if you were at 7 pesos to the dollar, the standard of living is still far, far cheaper. And I always tell people that if you have, excuse me, like if you're someone that's on Social Security, as an example, and you have $2,500 a month that's coming in from your check or your retirement, if you have $2,500, $3,000, and you're living in Medellin, you almost can't spend that much mm-hmm. money. I mean, and it sounds crazy for Americans to hear that, but it's very true. That would be like, you know, like having maybe $20,000, $25,000 a month tax-free in the United States. And it's just like, for most people, I'm sure you could spend it. I mean, I'm exaggerating, obviously. But for most people that are just normal, that just maybe go out to eat every once in a while, might go to the movies, you don't buy anything extravagant, you're going to have a lot of savings at the end of the month that you can parlay into other investment opportunities and just increase your purchasing power and grow your wealth, as opposed to being on this kind of hamster wheel that I think a lot of Americans find themselves on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if you can get out of, paying all your money in interest, there's different ways to do that, to lower your debt or make interest your loans work for you. Some people use infinite banking. Have you ever? What are your thoughts on infinite banking?
I haven't researched it much. I have not. But to your point, there's also great opportunities in real estate, not just in owning the assets, but in hard money. I've done that once, and I'm thinking about doing that a lot more in the future, because in Colombia, and I'm not sure how it is in Mexico, I'm assuming you could do the same thing, but there's a lot of gringos that are down there that are looking for mortgages to buy property, even at like 40-50% LTV. Mm-hmm. So if you go down there and you got 100, 200, 300 grand, you can lend that out and in dollar terms. So you're lending out dollars, you're getting paid back in dollars, but you're getting a 10, 12% interest rate on the hard money for, call it, 2 or 3 years. So you've got this asset, which is the debt you own, that's backed up by physical real estate in a market where the downside is very low because of what we talked about earlier with the lack of debt in the market itself, the lack of mortgages. And you've got this dollar denominated asset that's paying you 10% per annum. That's a pretty, try to find that type of return on your investment in a dollar denominated asset in the United States. You're going to have a tough time. Although Puerto Rico is very interesting. I don't know if you've looked into Puerto Rico mm-hmm. lately. I'm starting to snoop around there a little bit and kick some tires, because it is a market, as you know, that's dollar denominated, but it's a real estate market, probably the only one that's dollar denominated, that has just been tanking. I mean, mm-hmm. they got hit with the bankruptcy, then they got hit with the hurricane, and now they're just getting smoked by the virus.
Yeah.
And their market, properties in Condado, I haven't looked at Dorado or St. Regis or anything, but right there in Condado, just looking at it from a distance on Zillow, maybe 2 or 3 properties out of 10, you see that $75,000 price cut, $50,000 price cut, and you look at it just going down, 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 mm-hmm. down, down. And that's when I like to be a buyer. I don't like to buy when the chart's going like this. Sure. I like to buy it when it's super cheap. And as far, I don't know if you guys talk about RV ratios, but the prices are getting so low that you can get close to a 1% RV ratio, when I define that by mm-hmm. the monthly gross rent relative to the cost basis, and under the cost of construction.
Yeah, that's a great measure to go by, for sure. And I imagine that, I mean, maybe it's not at its peak now, but with all the people that are having exodus from these giant U.S. cities, that a lot of people are considering, you know, taking advantage of Act 20 and 22 more than before. So there's going to be a lot of people with money as they're, you know, as these friggin' politicians, the only thing they can think of is to hire taxes, you know, in the big cities as things are getting worse. Why would anybody stay there? You know, they're looking for better places to go. And that's the only place you can go as a U.S. citizen and not pay federal income tax.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic point. And when I first went to Puerto Rico for Act 2022, it was in 2013. Mm-hmm. So that's when it just started. Yeah. And I remember very well just being in line at all the places where you had to register to vote and get your driver's license. And you can always see the gringos that are in line. I mean, we stick out like a sore thumb, mm-hmm. regardless of where we are. And you see a couple people there, oh, hi. And then you see them in the next stop when they're registering to vote, or, you know, later in the afternoon or whatever. And they're all there for the same reason. So you kind of get to talking with people. And most of them then were from California. And they were business owners, and they could work remotely, or they had a business that was conducive to Act 20. And that's why they were there. But now, I mean, everyone and their mothers, you got Schiff there, you got Simon Black, you got Yaron Brook, Mike Maloney, Harry Dent. I mean, the list goes on and on. And I won't give out any names, but I'm pretty good friends with a lot of the guys and gals on FinTwit. And a lot of the people that you'd see on Real Vision or Macro Voices, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with those shows, but a lot of the FinTwit people and a lot of people in the digital marketing space. And a lot of them have hit me up, direct messaged me on Twitter saying, hey, tell me more about Act 20 and 22. Mm-hmm. And I won't say any names, but I'm supposed to meet a couple of these individuals in Puerto Rico in September. We'll see if they can get down there. For dinner, because they're like 90% sure they're going to move from, both these people are actually in California, they're going to move from California to Puerto Rico to take advantage of that. So, and I know a lot of Bitcoin guys and gals went as well. And so you've got this influx. So a lot of people ask me, well, aren't you worried about the Puerto Rican economy if you're buying real estate there? And I mean, not really, not as much as I otherwise would be in like a city in the United States, because I'm not buying just like a house out in the suburbs of San Juan, where it's going to be really predicated upon your success or failure is going to be determined by the local economy to a certain degree. But if you're going into Condado, I mean, that's where all these people that are Act 20 and 22, that's where they're all going, either that or Dorado.
Dorado, yeah.
So if you're getting hyper-focused there and you're going into properties that cater to these individuals, I'm not too worried about the local economy, because I think you're going to have demand for those types of products long-term, especially if the United States and states like California, Illinois, New York, New Jersey, et cetera, continue to raise taxes. I mean, there was this proposal, I don't know if you saw it, that came out in California, I believe within the last 2 weeks, where it was a retroactive wealth tax.
Yeah.
It went back 10 years, 10 years.
Yeah.
So if you were living in California in 2010 and left to go to Mexico or Italy or Russia, wherever, you could still be liable for a 0.4% wealth tax. Now, a lot of people, I kind of bashed that a little bit on Twitter, as you can imagine. And the pushback I got from people that were obviously living in California trying to rationalize this is they say, oh, yeah, but that doesn't really matter, because it's just on people who make $30 million or have a wealth of over $30 million. And it's just 0.4%. And, you know, anyone that responds like that, you can tell they don't understand history, or they've never read history at all. Because when you look at, let's take the income tax as an example, when it started in 1913, sure, you could say, oh, it was just for the rich. And it was just on incomes, I believe it was like $500,000 and above. And back then, that was an astronomical amount of money. Mm-hmm. And I believe 6%. And I think it might have been 1% at lower brackets, but they had enough write-offs to where it wasn't really, it didn't really matter. So those numbers could be up, but it gives you an example there. And then you just go, what, 4 or 5 years to 1918 when we had World War One, and that rate shot up over 70%. You say, oh yeah, George, that's because of World War One. Fine, look at 1922. The rates were still 58%. 58 within a matter of less than a decade. My whole point there is, if you understand history and how governments operate, sure, it starts at a 0.4% wealth tax on 30 million and above, but you blink your eye and the next thing you know, it's 1%, it's 2%, and then it's going from 30 million down to 10 million, down to a million. And while at the same time, they're not adjusting for inflation, by the way.
Right.
Right. So let's say that that we have inflation go up to 1970s level, where we're tacking on 10, 15% per year. So now all of a sudden, that home that you own right now, as someone that's middle class, that home you own in California that's, let's say, $800,000. Well, what happens when that goes to $8 million, but yet you haven't increased your purchasing power at all? Because the house has just gone up with the rate of inflation, and then all of a sudden, they drop that wealth tax from $30 million down to $5
million. Yeah.
Now what? Now you're right in the crosshairs for $3 million. And let's say it goes up to 5% or 10%, something like that, right? Well, where are you going to get that liquidity? So let's say you got $3 million that's in the zone, let's call it the no bueno zone. That's what I always say on my videos. But let's say you've got $3 million in there and it's at 10%. You got $300,000. Where are you going to come up with that? Mm-hmm. As someone middle class, you're going to have to take a loan against your equity just to pay that tax, and then you're going to have to pay down. I mean, who's going to be willing to do that? People just don't understand that once the camel gets its nose under the tent, you got big problems, and it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. And again, I think the majority of those people are people who currently live in California. They can see the writing on the wall, but for whatever reason, whether it's just, I mean, a lot of them are just lazy, but other, I get it. You know, they've got family, they've got a job, they just can't pick up and leave. I totally get that. But whatever reason, they're trying to rationalize this to allow themselves to sleep at night and to not feel this constant stress that I think if they were just honest with themselves and looked around, they'd say, wait a minute, this is a gorgeous place to live, awesome beaches, fantastic weather, all, you know, you got Tahoe, you've got the Bay, you've got Southern California and the coastline, you've got Monterey, for heaven's sakes, but everything, the walls are closing in. And if you're a producer, then you've got a huge target on your back. And at some point, you got to know that they're going to take what you have, whether you like it or not.
Yeah. And also, yeah, since we're talking about California, I mean, it's one of the states that's harder. Well, you know, once you move, so, you know, say that you want to just move to Texas. Okay. You don't want to pay California state tax anymore. It's not as easy. You just move there and say, oh, I'm a resident here. There's a lot of things you have to do. You have to cut all ties. You have to move all bank accounts. You have to really put in some work. It might take some time because it's up to California for them to say whether you have to pay state income tax or not. So something that people might need to think about, because it's, you know, it's something you have to plan for ahead of time. And it might take more, you know, if you have a lot of roots in California, a lot of things going on, then it might, you know, take a concerted effort. It's going to take you some while. Take you a while to not because, you know, if you're going to stay within the states or at least keep a residency there, then you're going to have to cut all your ties to California. Maybe just go back to visit or whatever if you want to. I wanted to ask you. So are you saying are you doing the Puerto Rico program now?
I've been there since 2013.
Oh, okay. So now do you have to stay there six months out of the year? Is that's how it works, right?
No. So this has changed, and I'm by no means an expert, but mm-hmm. this is how my lawyer laid it out back in 2013. I think if anything, though, it's more liberal now.
Okay.
because back then you had to have a specific number of employees and do all these things. And now I don't even think that's the case. So, but back then, for the first year, you needed to spend 6 months in a day. You needed to spend right. more time in Puerto Rico than the United States, or you just need to spend more than half the year in Puerto Rico. But after the first year, then you had two ways to be what they called a bona fide resident. Mm-hmm. And that either you could spend 6 months in a day in Puerto Rico per year, or you spend less than 90 days per year in the United States.
Ah, okay.
And that's why I qualify easy, because I don't, you know, I just go back to the United States now just for a few visits to visit friends mm-hmm. or see my family on the holidays, stuff like that.
So, where are you from originally?
Originally, I was born and raised in Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
And then my family moved down to Vegas. Okay. And my mom still lives in Vegas. My sister lives in Dallas. And then my younger brother lives in Arizona, so close to my mom there in Vegas. So it's kind of the Southwest is where we like to hang out. So that's where I go when I go back to the States. But it's never close to 90 days per year.
Sure.
So, you know, a lot of people that ask me about Act 2022, they say, yeah, I mean, it's great for the taxes, but I don't know if I want to live on an island and blah, 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 blah.
The heat.
And I'm like, you don't have to. Mm-hmm. You don't have to. Just go. You spend 6 months. And then go to Switzerland, go wherever you want, go to Dubai, go to Montenegro, or go to Colombia, go to Mexico. And I don't think people realize that. But again, I think people just, we as humans like routine. And I think when we get, especially if you lived in the same area for years on end, maybe you're born and raised there and you still live there. You all the restaurants, you know, I think people feel as though, or they like to feel as though they have control over their lives. And although we don't, I think people like to feel like they do. And I think that's the cognitive dissonance that kind of is triggered by someone thinking about moving to a place that's unknown. And, I just, unfortunately, especially in the world that we live in today, I think that's going to be extremely detrimental for most people who fall into that category. And I think we're just naturally hardwired. I someone like me, I think I'm kind of an anomaly. But now more than ever, I think people have to realize that, and they have to kind of force themselves to get outside of their comfort zone, because they see what's coming down the pipeline. As an example, and I'm not saying that California or the United States is going to be Venezuela or Weimar Germany or Zimbabwe or any of these places that have collapsed, but why can't California be the next Detroit?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you have to ask yourself, with those people that haven't left Detroit yet, and or, you know, using Venezuela, Zimbabwe, those people that didn't leave, why didn't they leave, right? Why didn't people leave Nazi Germany? At some point in time, you don't think when this crazy guy with the mustache gets elected, you're not like, okay, I'm out. Mm-hmm. Why? What? Because they were saying the exact same things that people are saying right now in California. Oh, it'll never happen here. Oh, you're just wearing a tinfoil hat. Oh, look around us. I mean, the fort that's beautiful here. Look at the mountains. We're right in the middle of Europe. It's gorgeous. Everyone wants to come here. This is a place where everyone wants to be. Can't you? And people have a tendency to take a snapshot of how things exist today, right now, and extrapolate that indefinitely into the future. But as we see going back through history, every decade things change dramatically. Look at back at 2000. Could anyone predict that we would have gone through 2008, 2009 and be where we were in 2010? Same thing in 2010 to 2020. Could anyone predict
Yeah.
that we would be, that the whole world would be in a total lockdown right now.
Nuts.
And people would be forced to stay in their houses, and governments would be shutting down businesses all over the world. I mean, people would have told you that you're absolutely crazy. And look at the rise of China. Look at the rise of Singapore. Yeah, obviously, I'm going back more than a decade. But look at it, the world changes. It shifts. The things that are true today aren't necessarily true in 10 years. And again, I'm not saying that the United States is going to be Germany or Venezuela or anything like that. But I am saying that at some point, if something's on a downward trajectory or you don't like the way things are going, you've got to come to a conclusion within your own mind that, okay, if it goes past this point, I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm out.
And some line in the sand.
Keep making excuses to stay there when it's past that threshold.
Yeah. And that kind of also goes to the conversation I wanted to have with you. I saw your video on the Great Reset, and I thought that was very informative. You talked a lot about kind of the economic aspect of it. If people aren't familiar with it, then they definitely should look at it. It's something that's been put out by the World Economic Forum that basically, they want to take advantage of this crisis, right? Never let a good crisis go to waste. In the book, The Great Reset, you find out that's actually a Winston Churchill quote. It's not Rahm Emanuel. But anyways, I guess Rahm Emanuel took it from Winston Churchill. And they really have got a whole lot of stuff planned for you, for us, whether we like it or not. And it's kind of scary stuff. So you've looked a lot into it. What do you think? Well, first off, maybe we could explain a little bit, and I'd like to see what your thoughts are about counteracting this, working around this. You think this is actually going to go, is this just them theorizing, or are we really going to feel the brunt of this social, giant global social engineering thing that they're trying to heave upon us?
It depends where you live.
Yeah.
And I think that you have to look at the countries that are going this direction. It's mostly the West. Mm. And if you look at countries that are just completely ignoring this as though it doesn't even exist, personally, those are the countries where I would want to be and invest moving forward. Because what this global reset or great reset, and I would challenge any of your viewers or listeners, when we get done, just go to YouTube and type in World Economic Forum Great Reset, and just watch a little clip of that, maybe a minute, 3 minute summary. The World Economic Forum actually put them out on YouTube, and if that doesn't freak you out, if that doesn't scare you, it's almost like a parody. Mm-hmm. Like you're watching a James Bond villain, and I'm not saying that to be funny. It's literally true. Trust me. If you watch that, the first thing that's going to come into your head is, my gosh, these people are James Bond villains. And not that means anything, but you start to look at what they want, and it's bizarre. It's not just green energy and clean air. Obviously, I think that that's a good thing. How you achieve that objective, I think, is debatable. But, I mean, okay, so that's a good thing, but... And then, but it's, they want this equality in everything. And they even say that they don't want equality of opportunity. They want equality of outcome. And they say that multiple times. Even this guy, Klaus Staub, I think his name is, that runs the thing. He's got a blog post where he outlines his vision for this great reset. And in multiple times, he says equal outcome, equal outcome, equal outcome. And again, if you know your history, when countries try to produce equal outcomes, that doesn't pan out. That's mm-hmm. when you get 100 million people dying in communist Russia or in China. That equal opportunity is what we should strive for. Equal outcome is a complete disaster.
Yeah.
Because it's just because no one's born equal. we should have equal rights.
Yeah.
We should have equal, again, opportunity. But none of us is created equal. As an example, my parents divorced when I was 7 years old. I have scoliosis,
mm-hmm.
but I'm 6'4". But I'm so we all have our strengths and our weaknesses. None of us are equal.
Yeah.
So to try to force equality is just you're going against human nature. But from an economic standpoint, really the problem here is they're trying to have a tops-down approach, a central planning type of approach to allocating resources. And that never ends well. And that's the problem, one of the main problems, that collapsed the Soviet Russia economic system, is there was no price discovery, and they wasted precious resources that have alternative uses, scarce resources. And so it's just impossible for bureaucrats and just a few people at the top to pull all these levers perfectly to micromanage the economy, and it just doesn't work, right? So yeah. This is what they want to do, but the net result will be fewer goods and services produced, because by definition, a central planner can't do it as well as a free market. I mean, I don't even think people on the way left, they always bash capitalism and whatnot, but if you talk to them, well, do you want a free market? Very few people are against a free market. They can see the benefits there. And so and then you'd argue that, can you control your home finances? Can you make better decisions for your family and for yourself than Klaus sitting in Switzerland at the World Economic Forum? Most people would answer yes. I know more about my family, and I can make better decisions for my family than Klaus can and his cronies. So it's not a real tough sell, I don't think. But my point is that they destroy the goods and not all, but you have fewer goods and services that are produced. And if fewer goods and services are produced, that means less tax revenues generated by the government. So if there's less tax revenue coming into the government, then they're having to monetize them, meaning the Fed and the Treasury, have to monetize more of the debt. Well, that means more currency units going out and circulating into the real economy, chasing fewer goods and services. That's where you get severe, severe inflation. And so without diving into the gory details of what they want to do, and if you look at it, you could get very conspiratorial, because I won't go into it, but you're like, okay, it seems just very coincidental.
Yeah.
That this virus comes up, and then all of a sudden they've got this master plan to control the world and the universe based on this opportunity. And yeah. That's their words, not mine.
Sure.
Opportunity. So anyway, check out the YouTube videos. You'll see what I'm saying.
Yeah, to implement a global technocratic surveillance and control grid. I mean, it's not very good. I have a friend named Hervoya. He is the host of the Geopolitics and Empire podcast. He's a history teacher, geopolitics professor, and he has all these top level people on and stuff. And I had a meal with him last weekend in Guadalajara, and he is just freaking out. He does not know. He's like, look, I studied history, I studied these types of things, and this is not good. I don't know what we can do about it, but this is horrible, and
yeah,
he's just freaking out.
Well. Doesn't end well. The good news is there are a lot of countries that are just they don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah.
Now, oddly, these are the countries that most Americans would think are the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see where we are in 10, 20 years. Those people that or those countries that for throughout the last 100 years or so, we've seen as totalitarian and authoritarian and some place that would not be a good place to live. Who knows, in 20 years, they may be the countries that are embracing free market capitalism, mm-hmm. while the West and the United States is embracing Marxism.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'd like to talk about another strategy I don't think I've talked about on the podcast, but I think is something that's interesting, is also say, if somebody's in California or wherever you are, and you see this kind of stuff coming down the pike, you can't move. obviously, it's very important to have people that you can trust, that if, you know, things do get hard, the people around you physically that you can be with. And you can put together what you can call it whatever you want to, you know, a club or an agreement, and you can trade within yourselves. You can, you know, if things have to be private, you know, you can have, if they're going to be doing all this social distancing, whatever, you can't do this and that. Well, buy a place or rent a place where you can do your meetings or do whatever you want to do. And, you know, just, I guess, you know, what they would consider to be agorism, or just try to stay as private away from the government as possible, but having a good group of people that you can trust and that you can trade with, kind of off the grid type things or whatever, that might be one way that you can do it if you can't, you know, go anywhere where you feel, you know, that you're not able to, I don't know how to explain it, but if you're in a place.
I think you touched on a great point there. And I realize I'm sitting here bashing California and everything, right, but there are a lot of people that just can't leave. So me beating California with a stick, so to speak, isn't doing them any good. So, right. So what can the person do that is required to stay there for whatever reason? I think first and foremost, they can rent. I mean, my goodness gracious, if you own a home in California, hit the bid yesterday. I mean, take your money and run, and just take the equity out and invest it somewhere that's going to be much more friendly to capital. What I always suggest real estate people do is just, if you've got a bunch of equity in California, hit the bid, take the equity, and invest it in a more linear market that's got a lot less downside. Now, I'm the first to say that U.S. real estate as a whole is wildly overpriced and most likely in a bubble. But there are areas outside of California where you've got a lot less downside, and also where your capital doesn't necessarily have a huge target on it. So I would just get my money, let's say, outside of California, and I would rent, and I would also look for a place that was a little more rural where I could make my own rules and not have to abide by who knows what they come up with next. And also, too, I don't know that there's a zero probability of California not having extreme social unrest. And so, you look at what, and I don't know what the situation is like in the United States, but I know I saw the headlines a month ago or so, and obviously there's riots, there's looting, there's all of these things. You're going to notice that those typically happen, or happen more often, or to a greater extent, in cities, counties, and states that are, let's say, more left-leaning. And I dislike both parties equally. I think the right is just as bad as the left. I think they're all just a bunch of crooks, personally. So I'm not here to say that the right's good and the left is bad. But I am here to say that if you're someone with Antifa, or if you're someone who's one of these rioters, looters, there's a lot less chance that you go to jail for rioting in L.A. than if you do it in Dallas, Texas. To say the least.
Well, Dallas is pretty blue now, you know.
Right. Well, you see my point.
Yeah, so not as bad as LA, though.
I just really would want to be out of the line of fire, so to speak, and just, you know, why live downtown LA? Why not just go out to at least a suburb where you can get out of the mayhem? Or if you're in San Francisco, I know the Bay Area well. So if you're in downtown San Francisco, why not just go out to the East Bay? You know, go out to San Ramon, or you know, maybe try to go out a little further. And so if it does hit the fan for any length of time, that you've got, you can just watch it from a distance. Another thing that it's kind of maybe outside the box that a lot of my friends have done in Phoenix, Arizona. I went to college there, so I've got a lot of buddies there still. And what they've done is they've just bought RVs.
Yeah.
And so I know they had some social unrest in, believe it or not, Scottsdale and in Tempe. And my buddies don't want anything to do with that. They don't like that stuff at all.
Yeah.
So as soon as they see that coming, they're like, yep, okay, I'm out. They get in the, they take their families, their kids, they've got all their food and everything set up in their RV, and they just drive up to Sholo, or they drive up to Snowflake, or one of these little towns up in the mountains where no one's going to bother. You just park in a little RV spot, you got Wi-Fi, you got everything you need, and you just watch it from a distance. So I think that's something small that everyone can do. Number one, make sure you're renting. Number two, try to be a little outside of the urban areas. And then number three, just have a little RV. So if you don't like what's going on, you can always just drive up to the mountains or just temporarily drive over to another state.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I want to see if real quick we could just get, if you could just tell us real quick, if somebody is in the States or, you know, considering a new place to live or something like that, thinking of going internationally, can you list off some places real quick that you see as maybe somewhere that people should consider looking into?
I think it all depends on their personal preference and what they prioritize. As an example, I'm someone who really likes nice weather.
Yeah.
And so for me, Medellin is perfect because I don't think you're going to find a place in the entire world that has better weather than Medellin. They call it the Valley.
Where I am, it does.
Well, have you looked at the weather in Medellin?
Oh, yeah. I spent a good time there. I know it's phenomenal, but still, where I am, San Miguel de Allende, it's better.
Okay. All right. And
but I know it's great there.
The weather, you've got the climate, you've got, you know, you're a 45-minute flight from Cartagena, a lot of the places, Barranquilla, a lot of the places on the coast there on the Caribbean. You've got Bogota right there. You've got access to all of South America. You've got an incredibly low cost of living and great people, great food. Yeah. So if those, great entertainment, you know, salsa dancing. And if those are priorities for you, then I would strongly suggest checking out Colombia, especially if you're someone who's entrepreneurial and you're kind of leaning towards like the tourism space, maybe real estate, Airbnb, short-term rentals. I think tourism, once we get this COVID thing in the rearview mirror, it was just growing exponentially in Medellin. And I think it will continue to do so for many, many years, regardless of what's going on with the local economy there. Now, if you're someone that wants to, you know, make $100 million, and you're someone young, I don't know that Medellin would be perfect. Mm. I think it might be a decent bet, but I might suggest going somewhere over closer to Asia, somewhere closer to China, maybe India, somewhere that's much more developing and has just a huge, huge population, where if you start a business and you get in kind of on the ground level, like a Myanmar, something like that, then, and there could be just massive, massive upside there. And if you're someone that is, maybe you have some wealth and you're concerned about these big governments coming after the wealth and you might not like Colombia, I would look at a place like Dubai. I would, believe it or not, I would even look at a place like Russia, especially if you're an investor. Russia is very interesting because, and I know they have Putin and I get it. I understand the downside and I understand the arguments against that. And there are very good arguments against it. But when you look at their debt to GDP as an example, when you look at a lot of the metrics that we use from a macro standpoint to look at a country, Russia looks pretty darn good, and they're not buying into this Klaus and his cronies at the World Economic Forum, especially if you're someone who is a believer that the price of oil, I mean, was it now maybe 44, is going to go up and not down over the next, call it, 2 or 3 years. Those are countries that would benefit tremendously. Another one, Brazil. Brazil isn't buying into the whole Klaus deal, and there's someone that could benefit tremendously. Now, they've been a basket case for a long, long time, but there are countries that offer very interesting opportunities to the upside if you want to just massively grow a business and create a lot of wealth. So again, it really depends. Now, if you're someone that's really hyper-focused on personal freedom and liberty and mobility, and you're very concerned about maybe the virus lasting for quite a while, I would strongly suggest the Caribbean, because you are, I mean, like a 5 hour and 8 hour boat ride from like 10 different countries. Mm-hmm. So if you have some means, especially if you're an American, go to Puerto Rico, set up everything under Act 2022, and then you've got Cuba right there. And a lot of people say, oh, Cuba, that's ridiculous. But people don't realize that, that Cuba is the only place in the world that doesn't keep flight records. And so I've had I've had a lot of interesting conversations with my buddy Robert Barnes, and I don't know if you know who he is.
No, I'm not familiar with him.
He's a free speech lawyer and a constitutional lawyer that represented Alex Jones.
Oh, sure, against, yeah, I've seen this guy. Yeah,
against Twitter.
Yeah,
and he's a very, very high profile lawyer. But he also works with people who have been victims of domestic violence, and helping them get to a place where they'll be safe. And a lot of times he has them go through Cuba for that reason. Most people, in fact, when he told me that, I'd never even thought of that. But my point is, if you're one of those people who really values your personal freedom and your personal data, but it, you know, you just don't like the NSA and you don't like this Big Brother Orwellian thing. The Caribbean's very interesting. And I right now I'm in St. Barts, and if I don't like what's going on in St. Barts, all I have to do is just go on my computer and look at what country literally is within 100 miles of where I am that might have some more freedom or less restrictions, or I might like it better. And I either just hop on a little puddle jumper and go over there. It's very cheap to charter a flight, or you can just charter a yacht or a boat and you know, pay them $800 or whatever, and they'll shoot you right over to St. Martin or to Antigua or St. Kitts or wherever you want to go. So you've got a lot of options there in the Caribbean.
Yeah. I remember my dad's from Puerto Rico, and I remember when I was little, I used to spend a lot of time there with my family and stuff, the summers. And I remember thinking when I was young, I mean, like 10 years old, younger, I was like, man, somebody could just disappear in Puerto Rico. Like, I didn't spend time in Dorado or the nice places when I was younger. It was more of like the poor areas. But I was like, man, nobody would ever know where you could be here for the rest of your life. No one could ever find you. You know, it's kind of funny. And I actually was one of the first the first team of brokers for Peter Schiff's offshore bank. That's we started in Barbados, you know, Europe Pacific Bank.
Yeah, sure.
And we started in Barbados, and the government was just giving us kind of a hard time about immigration and whatever and all this type of stuff. And I wrote about it, and they actually put us in like a cell for a couple hours because they thought we fit the description of drug dealers or something, because we said we had money and we didn't want a job there. Anyways. We said, forget it. We don't want to deal with this. Boom. We just took a flight, St. Vincent. And, it's like you said, a puddle jumper, less than an hour. We're somewhere else. Forget it. You know, that could have easily done it on a ferry or whatever.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, thanks a lot. I mean, you've been really gracious with your time. I think we've talked about some great stuff today. I really want to encourage listeners to go and check out your videos. I've only seen your videos. Do you have other stuff? Do you offer courses or anything like that?
We have a product called Rebel Capitalist Pro. Rebel Capitalist is the show I do on my YouTube channel, along with the whiteboards, where I've teamed up with Lynn Alden, Chris McIntosh. So if people want to check that out, they can go to georgegammon.com/pro. Or if you just want to check out the YouTube channel, or I post a lot on Twitter, it's just my name, George Gammon, typical spelling. First name and last name is G-A-M-M-O-N.
Okay, great. Seems like you've been building up some steam on the YouTube. I mean, you've been growing that pretty well, right, lately?
Well, I've only had it for about a year, and I've got 170,000 subscribers.
That's great. It's grown
quite a bit.
You've been putting in a lot of work, but you know, it's just really remarkable because these days, I mean, YouTube used to be a lot easier, but these days it's a lot harder to gain momentum. It's a lot harder to get good amount of views. But yeah. just consistency, right? You've really been putting out a lot of stuff.
Well, it's consistency, and you have to pay attention to the back end analytics. It's all about click through rates. It's all about retentions. I mean, you got to have great content, and if you've got really good content that people like to watch, then you're going to trigger that YouTube algorithm. And then it is about consistency, to your point. Yeah. But then it's just kind of a matter of time. And I mean, you know, if I can do it, anyone can do it. And the channel not only has 170,000 subscribers, but it gets almost 1.5 million views per month. Wow. Between 1.1 and 1.5, depending on how much I'm posting. During March, and when the market gets pretty volatile, it went up to over 2 million views per month. So a lot of traction there. To your point, YouTube is difficult, but it's definitely doable for sure if you're willing to put in the work.
All right. Great. All right. Well, George, thanks a lot for your time, and have a good one.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us for the Borderless Podcast, traveling, investing, and living beyond borders.